Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for the day, Greta Anderson. And I don't know about you, but I sure am thankful for that extra hour of sleep this weekend. In case you haven't noticed, tomorrow is shaping up to be a pretty big day. Here at KHOI, we've got a few last-minute election news items. Auditor Lucy Martin has promised to stop by on her way to work, so we get to talk to the woman who will be tallying votes Tuesday night. Really looking forward to that. Well, early voters this year have reported being overwhelmed by the 10 questions on the ballot regarding retention of judges. Here in Central Iowa, a total of 10 judges are up for retention, 3 on the Iowa State Court, Iowa State Supreme Court, 4 on the Iowa State Appeals Court, and then another 3 on the local district level. When I called the Iowa Bar Association to ask for some context on these retention votes, they directed me to Guy Cook, Des Moines lawyer and the chair of the bar's Fair and Impartial Courts Committee. Mr. Cook, why do we vote on judges? I thought that the judicial branch was separate from the legislative and executive branches, and those two are responsive to voters, whereas the judicial branch has always been put aside and allowed to be less partisan so that it can oversee the doings of the other two.
That's right. It's important to appreciate that a half a century ago, Iowans came together and amended our Constitution to remove politics from how judges are selected and kept on the bench. And we went to what's called a merit selection process to find our judges and put them on the bench, which involves a group of citizens and lawyers who sift through the applicants and look for the best with the greatest merit, and then nominate 2 or 3 candidates to the governor, who then appoints the judges or justices to serve. Those justices and judges then, every 6 or 8 years, stand for retention. And it's a different election than voting for sheriff or a state legislator or even governor. It's really a question of whether this judge or justice has done their job or have they committed misconduct. And it was never designed, and it should never be used, although it has been manipulated in the past, as a vehicle to express dissatisfaction with a particular ruling by a judge. It's important to appreciate that judges are not politicians. They do not issue rulings in return for votes, and we wouldn't want that, because then you would have judges or justices looking over their shoulder as to what's the popular position, as opposed to what does the law say, what is fair and impartial based on the facts. And so, simply put, the retention election for judges is just that. It's not a recall election. It's a retention election. And people ask me, well, I don't know anything about these judges. How should I vote? And the simple answer is, if you don't know anything bad, then they're worthy of retention. I say that somewhat flippant, but it's true. And what the Bar Association does every 2 years is survey the membership of the bar across the state, rural, urban, Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative, and ask them to rate the judges on a number of factors, knowledge of the law, temperament, fairness of their rulings, how they treat people. And then the judges are given a score based on that judicial review. All of these justices, Justice Apple, Katie and Hecht, and the judges on the Court of Appeals and the judges locally, all receive very high marks on this judicial review and are worthy of retention. And so the bar urges folks to turn over the ballot and vote yes to retain our high-quality justices and judges. More information and the details of this survey can be found at judicialfacts.org. That's judicialfacts.org. What is not probably known outside the legal community is that the judicial system in Iowa, our courts in Iowa, our judges and justices in Iowa, are routinely rated some of the best in the country, not by lawyers, but by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which most recently rated the fairness and impartiality of our justices and judges as number 5 in the entire country. And that's the result of the merit selection process we have, which removed politics from how we select judges.
Okay, I'm going to play devil's advocate here. If I heard that the Chamber of Commerce really liked a judge, I would think, well, maybe that's because the judge is always business friendly and maybe not as friendly to grievances against a business. Why is the Chamber of Commerce endorsement of our judges so important?
Well, it's because of the rule of law and reliability that a ruling by our court system or our justice or judges can be based upon the law and the facts, as opposed to how much money someone gave a judge for their reelection or some personal whim or what the public thinks the ruling should be. If you look at those countries that have high-quality judiciary outside the U.S., those are the countries where businesses want to do business because the system's predictable. And in the last judicial election in 2012, the chairman and CEO of the Principal Financial Group, obviously a large company in Iowa, authored an essay that said just that. It's the ability to predict the reliability of our court system, knowing that they will follow the law and be fair and impartial in their rulings, let the chips fall where they may, without influence by special interest groups.
I asked Mr. Cook whether the signs I was seeing around town to remove three Iowa Supreme Court justices had to do with the Iowa court's historic 2009 decision, Varnum versus Bryan, that opened the door for same-sex marriage in the state. His answer, in short, was yes.
Right. There, in 2010, Mr. Vanderplas and his group, the family leader, focused on one issue, the same-sex marriage decision, claiming that the justices had overstepped their bounds. God bless Bob Vanderplas, but he was flat wrong, and so was his group. The justices applied the law, the Equal Protection Clause under our Constitution, and found that treating same-sex couples different from other couples was a violation of the Equal Protection Clause. And a fundamental concept, if you think about the Pledge of Allegiance, which ends with liberty and justice for all, that's all the court was doing, was ensuring that everyone is treated fairly and equally under the law. And regrettably, Mr. Vanderplas and his group manipulated the system, and three fine folks lost their jobs, but nobody lost their rights. The same group is also involved this go-round. They were also involved in 2012. It's a little different this time. The family leader is not directly involved, although it's urging its membership to vote no on these justices who also authored the opinion. By the way, it was a unanimous opinion by judges appointed by Democrats and Republicans. It was an easy decision, frankly, if anyone studies the law, and has since been vindicated by other courts in the U.S. Supreme Court. So there were three justices up in 2010. They were voted out. In 2012, one justice, Justice Wiggins, who was also part of the opinion, was retained in spite of the efforts to vote him out. And this time, the last three justices who were involved in the decision, in fact, the author of the opinion, Chief Justice Kady, are on the ballot, Justice Kady, Apple, and Hecht. So it was a 7-0 opinion and unanimous, and the last three justices who were involved in that opinion are on the ballot. The effort this time around is led by an offshoot of the family leader called CommonSenseIowa.org and a gentleman by the name of Mr. Wacker. And he's the person behind the black signs that are popping up around the state.
Well, thank you so much, Guy Cook. Is there anything else you'd like to add about this judge retention issue?
Right. I would just urge folks to go to judicialfacts.org. That's a website where you can learn more information. But I would suggest that you turn over the ballot and vote yes to maintain our high-quality justices and judges and keep our courts fair and impartial. And don't let politics enter the process.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Again, that was Guy Cook, chair of the Iowa State Bar Association's Fair and Impartial Courts Committee, talking about the high performance ratings of all of the judges on our ballots. You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Well, late last week, the Center for Media and Democracy up in Madison, Wisconsin, released a report with some astonishing information about the flow of outside money into Iowa's races, in particular the Iowa State and Iowa Senate and Iowa House races. On the phone, I have researcher David Armiak from the Center of Media and Democracy. Are you there, David?
Yes, I am. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And it's not just any money we're talking about. It's money from two men, Charles and David Koch, i.e. the Koch brothers. And how much money are we talking about?
It looks like this cycle that the Kochs are spending through their Koch PAC, which is the Koch or the PAC, the political action committee that is associated with their company, Koch Industries, that they are spending $30,000 in Iowa State House and Iowa State Senate races. If you include the two U.S. Congress candidates, that equals a total of
$36,500. $36,000 into our races.
Correct.
Can you put that into context for us? Is that a lot of money? It sounds like a lot of money, but is it comparatively a lot of money?
It's a lot of money at the state level. So to give you an idea, the Kochs, if you look at the different races in the state for the candidates that they're backing 21 candidates for state house, 9 candidates for the state senate. So that's 30 candidates at the state level. If you add the two at the federal level, it's 32. That means you're only eclipsed by two other states, Oklahoma, whom the Kochs are supporting 43 candidates, and Texas, which no surprise, they're supporting 74.
Well, and there's a lot more candidates running in Texas. It's a bigger state.
Yeah, definitely. Right. Oklahoma as well. But in terms of money, it's hard to say exactly, you know, how much they are spending, right? Because this is what they're reporting, but of course they have other operations that they're running in the state. For example, Americans for Prosperity, which is what they call their grassroots group in the state, is there and has been there, particularly since 2014. And since the Kochs have pledged to spend this election, originally $889 million, and now $750 million, we know that a lot of that money is invested in organizations like Americans for Prosperity. We've seen that they have claimed that they have volunteers in the state that have made over a million phone calls on behalf of their causes. We know they have people going door to door in Iowa. They have been running training sessions for their grassroots leadership academy, which trains leaders for these groups. They also say that they have now 60,000 registered activists that they can turn to get people out. For example, on November 5th, which is just a couple of days ago, for their last day of action before the election tomorrow. In addition to all these, they have another group, Generation Opportunity, which has been active in Iowa, a group that focuses on young people or reaching out to young people for their causes. And they also hold day of actions. And in 2014, they ran ads opposing the Affordable Care Act in the state.
Wow. So they have a real ground game, it sounds like.
Yeah. And this is what they've been turning to across the country. And although you see stories of saying, you know, that they're retreating, I think a better word to use is reorganizing. Instead of focusing more on, you know, running ads, although we're all seeing a lot of these ads this cycle, behind the scenes, they are building up this network, working on this network. And other states are using an organization called the Libre Initiative to appeal to Latino voters. But I so far haven't seen anything, haven't seen them working in the state of Iowa.
Now, I can assume all of the candidates that they have contributed to are Republicans?
Yes. Besides two, it looks like Rep. Chris Hall and Rep. Bruce Beringer are the only Democrats receiving cash, but the majority of them, yes, are Republicans.
And these Americans for Prosperity and the Generation Opportunity, those funds, is that dark money? Is that we don't know exactly how much money is going into it, from whom? How does dark money play a role in all of this?
Sure. Yeah. It's hard to know exactly how much they're spending here, because they, although they're required to, you know, sort of file, they're not required to say where their donors are coming from. So, and this is due to the 2010 U.S. Supreme Court ruling, Citizens United versus FCC, which struck down the limits on, independent political spending, which allowed for a lot of this dark money to go through.
Okay. And so the Koch brothers are trying to obviously influence elections in Iowa. What are they hoping to get if the, if their people get into place? What are they seeking?
That's a very good question. I'm not in the state. I do know, through research, what kind of companies or operations they have there. And they have quite a few. Their company, Flint Hills Resources, is operating in Iowa. And they have plants. In fact, they have an office in Ames. They operate ethanol plants in Arthur, Iowa Falls, Fairbanks, Menlo, and Shell Rock. The Koch Pipeline Company is there, which operates the Wood River Pipeline, which crosses Iowa, or a portion of it. They have Georgia Pacific there, which has facilities in Dubuque and Monticello. And also Koch Fertilizer is there in Fort Dodge, where they have a plant, and they also have terminals in Fort Madison, Marshalltown, Washington, Garner, and Sergeant Bluff. So they have a lot of operations there. So if I was to speculate, I would say, that it would have something to do with one of these. They certainly have done lots of lobbying in the state. American Bridge has reported in the past that, they've lobbied on at least 37 bills in Iowa related to ethanol, biodiesel, and other renewable fuels. But they're no stranger to Iowa. In 2014, they, got a state senator by the name of Joni Ernst, to run on the Republican side for the Senate, through their backing and a dark money nonprofit financed and operated by the Kochs, they were able to get her successfully elected. And a lot of money was in that race. If you recall, the Freedom Party's Chamber of Congress had provided $400,000 of the $440,000 the group had raised to get her elected.
Yeah, I think I heard that there was some kind of legal issue maybe involved in that money, that maybe this 501c4 that was giving her money was actually not holding up its end of its very, minuscule end of the bargain, that even it was supposed to educate and wasn't educating. Or does that ring a bell?
Yes, correct. And in fact, the Center for Media and Democracy, along with Crew, had gotten together to file an IRS complaint about this. And we said in the complaint that the group misled the IRS by claiming it was not involved in political activity when it actually was. And it was actually engaged in more political activity allowed and operated by the private interests of senators and the Koch network. So we asked, the IRS to take action on this.
Was there any... Did it? Did the IRS take action?
I don't believe we've heard from them.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's been very difficult to get with the current climate to get any action on these things.
Right. So the Koch brothers are busy extracting resources from Iowa and making money off it, and they want to continue to do that. They have business interests in Iowa that they hope their candidates will consider when voting on laws. But I understand there's also a pretty close association between the Koch brothers and the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, that has a lot more ideological issues at hand, not simply, business mindset. Is that the case? That the Kochs are involved in ALEC, or we should kind of associate the two?
The Kochs have provided, financial backing to ALEC. And yes, oftentimes the two are associated with each other. To the exact activities of ALEC in Iowa, I am not an expert in this, but I do know that they are, influential in the state. And you can go to sourcewatch.org and, you know, do a simple search of Iowa ALEC, and you can find a running list of state politicians, in not only Iowa but every state that are currently members of ALEC that we know of, to trace this. We also have a database of model ALEC bills, right? Because ALEC, puts together model bills at their conferences, that they hold with state legislatures. State legislators take them back to their home states and present these bills, which then, may become law upon voting. So we offer that there, so you can kind of see or check if you are suspicious that a law may be an ALEC bill.
Right.
But, go ahead.
Well, so just to recap, the ALEC kind of is an organization that sort of coaches conservative legislators from various states, brings them together, says, here's a good piece of legislation that will further, the conservative agenda. And then it kind of makes it easy for the legislators to just, submit their bill to their House or Senate. And these are bills about a wide variety of things, education, guns.
Correct. Yes. Yeah. So, things like Stand Your Ground, right? Various school choice bills, supporting the charter school movement. What else? Things like, supporting hunting and making hunting and fishing, part of the state constitution. There's a wide variety of different bills. And we will find out in the coming weeks here, because ALEC is holding their next conference here in early December, what some of the newer bills will be. If not already, they should be hosted up on the ALEC site.
So it's
constantly meeting a couple times a year to go over new types of model bills and to get the legislators to bring them back to their houses or state respectable houses to present to the people.
So it's an open secret what they're promoting in the various state legislatures. They just
let
everyone know what they're about.
I don't think that everybody, in terms of the state politicians, I'm not so sure that we hear them, sort of bragging about being members of ALEC or always informing the public that they're attending these meetings or what's going on at these meetings. And oftentimes they even receive, scholarships to attend. And these are at fancy hotels. They're meeting in, fancy restaurants.
So it's almost a little bit.
They want to disclose.
Yeah, you could almost say a little pay to play kind of thing. They give them a nice vacation.
Possibly, yeah.
OK, well,
oftentimes they're definitely in nice locations.
With scholarship. So, okay, so the Koch brothers, I actually heard they were not big Trump supporters. Is that
correct? Yes.
Yeah.
As I mentioned earlier, so they had originally said that they were going to spend $889 million this election, and that's just something that they had pledged to do at one of their donor conferences, which are often, held at very fancy, nice places too. Trump had been nominated by the Republican Party, that number was reduced to $750 million, which is still a very large amount of money. But they said instead that they were going to focus, on down-race candidates. And we've seen a lot of that money in the Senate races, not so much in Iowa, but certainly here in Wisconsin, where the incumbent Republican Senator Ron Johnson is facing our old Democratic Senator, Russ Feingold. We're seeing, tens and tens of millions of dollars in this race. Part of that is due to the large money the Koch network has injected into the race. They have not publicly come out in support of Trump. We have not seen ads of theirs, from any of their vehicles, electioneering vehicles, supporting Trump.
Okay. Well, But they are supporting, 38 Iowa legislators.
32, counting the at the U.S. level.
Okay, 32. Okay, 32 legislators, 30 within the Iowa Senate, Iowa House, for a sum of $30,000, and then an extra $6,000 for our two legislators. It's the Koch brothers putting money into the Iowa elections. And as we heard from David, there's actually quite a bit of business that the Koch brothers do in Iowa. Thanks so much, David Arniak, Center for Media and Democracy. When we come back, Lucy Martin is here to talk about tomorrow's election, and our regular correspondent, Keith Morgan, will talk about active shooter scenarios. No relation between those two topics, by the way.
I'd like to build the world a home and furnish it with love. Grow apple trees and honeybees and snow white turtle doves. I'd like to teach the world to sing.
Sing with me.
Welcome back to Local Talk on KHOY. I'm Greta Anderson here with the woman of the hour, Lucy Martin, who, as Story County Auditor, serves as our county's chief election officer. This election cycle, Lucy, has been nothing less than crazy, with quite a bit of misinformation, it seems, coming from the mouth of at least one of the presidential candidates, who is encouraging his supporters to act as kind of vigilante poll watchers. I thought we'd start with that. Can you clarify the law on poll watching for our listeners?
Sure. Poll watching is allowed in all precincts in Iowa. However, all poll watchers have to be credentialed. That's a written credential. The two parties in Iowa, the Democratic and Republican Party, can have three poll watchers per precinct. And the non-party political organizations, the NPPOs, like Libertarians, Greens, New Independent Party of Iowa, as well as candidates nominated by petition, can have one poll watcher per precinct. And that is, they do have to carry a credential with them.
And these folks have already been trained by you in what to do.
Poll watchers aren't trained by me. They're trained by their parties or their candidates. And both parties know very well how to train their poll watchers. I don't have any doubt that they do that well.
Okay, but there's certain rules that they need to follow while they're in the polling place.
Sure. They observe. They can look at eligibility slips, which is what every voter signs to say that they are eligible to vote in that precinct. They can write down names. They're basically there to get out the vote and to look for people that have not shown up to vote yet and to give them calls or go to their houses. So they're not allowed to handle equipment, handle ballots. They're not allowed to interfere with voters, intimidate voters, hinder the process in any way.
Okay. And so the parties have already provided credentials to the people they are providing credentials to. And the notion of a volunteer, somebody just showing up to be a poll watcher on election day, that's not going to work.
Right. You can't just decide to watch a poll and show up. That's not how it works.
And if somebody did that, what would happen?
They would be asked to leave.
Okay. All right. And another question a lot of us have, this is kind of a point of curiosity about early voting. I just keep hearing about the early voting results from other states. And it makes me wonder, I mean, it seems like you would want to keep those early voting results, like the satellite and the voting that takes place in your office, under lock and key until the polls close at 9 p.m.
They are
on
under
Tuesday.
Lock and key.
Okay.
And whether you vote by mail or cast a ballot in my office or go to a satellite site, those are all absentee ballots. Those are all sealed in the voter's affidavit, and those are counted on election day. They're actually sealed in buckets right now in a locked room. and I actually borrow stop motion cameras from the sheriff's office so that if there is any infiltration of the room after hours, we know what's happening. Those ballots are counted on Election Day, and then those results are not tabulated until the polls close at 9 p.m. Results from other states I can't speak for. I wonder if it's the result of exit polling at those early voting locations.
Or possibly the registration, their party registration,
right,
making assumptions about how people will vote.
Right. And I would never make an assumption about how people vote based on their party registration personally, but that's just me.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. About those absentee ballots, we're kind of getting down to crunch time as far as getting those back in. Well, it's obviously crunch time election-wise, but if people have an absentee ballot in their home and they haven't, maybe they filled it out, maybe they haven't, but they want to vote, what's the best thing for them to do right now, today, Monday?
The best thing probably is to deliver it by hand to my office either today or tomorrow. If they are hand-delivered, they can be delivered up to 9 p.m. tomorrow when the polls close. I would do it today if you have a mailed absentee ballot. You can also mail it today. It needs to be postmarked no later than today. It can't be postmarked tomorrow or later. If you're taking it to the post office, I would ask to have it hand-canceled so that that postmark is clear on it.
Yeah, speaking to some people yesterday, there was some confusion. They thought they had until the 14th to return their absentee ballot.
No, the election results are canvassed on the 15th, which is – so the results that we'll have tomorrow night are unofficial. And then the results on the 15th are canvassed by the Board of Supervisors. Those are the official results.
The official one. So that gives
It can arrive by that late date, but it has to be postmarked no later than today.
Right. Assuming that the post office might take a whole week to get that thing.
Right. And we had ballots go all over the world. So as long as they arrive before canvass and they are postmarked November 7th or earlier, they can be considered by the absentee board for counting.
Okay. Another issue that I came across when I was speaking with people yesterday, folks who had either moved or changed their name and hadn't contacted your office yet about registration, pre-registration. What are the options for them if they want to vote?
If they are already registered in Story County and they've moved or they've had a change of name, they should go to their current polling place, which corresponds with their current residential address, and let the election officials there know that they've had a change of address or a change of name, and that can be done at the polls. They will need to show some form of ID if you're changing precincts. If you've moved within your precinct, you don't have to. If you are brand new to Story County, and that includes people that were registered elsewhere in the state of Iowa, then you have to go through Election Day registration procedures. You will have to prove both your identity and your current address. That could be the same piece of a documentation if your driver's license is up to date, not expired, and has your current address on it. Or if you have an old address on that, then bring a utility bill, a bank statement, some sort of government document like your property tax statement or your vehicle registration.
Some kind of official mail that's come to your residence.
Right, that proves your residency and has your name on it, not your spouse's name, not your roommate's name, okay, not a P.O. box.
Okay. Now, we've heard other states do things like purge lapsed voters from the polls or purge people who haven't voted in a long time. There's no operation like that in Iowa, is there?
Well, it's against federal law to purge voters within 90 days of a federal election. I think that's 90 days. We have annual processes that we go through every year, where we match up with the post office national change of address cards. We send no activity letters to people that haven't participated in an election for a certain number of years. And we also match up our records with other states to make sure that we have most current information and people that have moved out of jurisdiction are canceled. We do maintenance on our voter registration records every day. So
okay. So based on information you're getting from various sources,
right, and that includes obituaries and funeral home notices, FYI.
Oh, so, my goodness.
Yeah.
It's the dead cannot vote.
Yeah, we look at those every day. And if we cancel your voter registration based on a printed obituary or funeral home notice or a notice of a death certificate from the state of Iowa.
Okay. Well, you've got a big day and a half and a 2 days and a half. You've got a big week ahead of you, I should say. How are you feeling?
Tired. It's a marathon.
Yeah.
For me, the mental deadline is November 18th, which is the recount deadline. So.
Okay. And then you kind of can take a deep breath.
Yes.
You are up for a re-election this year.
I am.
How's your campaign gone?
I don't have a probably a terrible candidate. I've been so busy with work.
Do you have an opponent?
I do have an opponent. I guess I don't have a lot of emotional space to worry about my own campaign, which I probably should. But
so your emotional space is dealing with all of this.
Right.
What worries you the most about election 2016?
I just want all the equipment to work and all of my many, many election officials to remember their training and to remain calm and patient, and that the voters to understand that the election workers, they run elections as often as people go vote. So especially in the morning, they are getting up to speed on the process, and all they are doing is ensuring that everybody is treated the same and that the law is followed. So if there's a line and people should expect lines, please be patient.
Okay. Well, we wish you the best of luck. We wish you a very smooth sailing tomorrow. I've lived here for 10 years and have never noted that there's ever been much trouble voting in Story County. So
we have a very good system in Iowa, and I think myself and all other 98 auditors are very proud of that system. So,
well, we do have. I just should say that there will be. There's new machines, aren't there? I mean, the machine that I used to vote seemed a little different, or the system seemed a little different than last time.
We got new machines in April of 2015. So, if you are a more infrequent voter, this might be your first encounter with them. The ballot tabulator counter is very similar, and then we have a touchscreen machine, which is merely a ballot printer, and that's our ADA device, but any voter is allowed to use that. It prints out a paper ballot that then goes in the tabulator.
Okay. The paper ballot is what's tabulated.
Right. If you have voted on a touchscreen, it prints out a paper ballot, and that can be hand-counted if necessary, and I hope we don't get to that point, but you never know. And okay. It also can be tabulated on the ballot scanner.
Okay. So that's kind of a touchscreen interface, but you get almost something like a receipt. You don't get to keep it, but you get to make sure.
No, that's your ballot. Yeah.
Yeah. You get to make sure that you voted for who you intended to vote for.
Right. And before you print it, you can check that as well. And you can spoil it just like the paper ballot. So if you're going to the polls tomorrow, most people will be voting on a paper ballot. If you choose to use the ADA device, it does print out a paper ballot for you as well.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, it's going to be exciting.
That's one word for it.
Thanks for stopping by, Lucy.
Thank you. And I'd like to thank Keith. He helps set up the polling places in Story City and Lafayette Township for us. So thanks,
all right.
Keith.
Yeah, there was a bit of a misunderstanding on that. I thought all I was going to be hired to do is lift equipment, and it involved technical stuff, but I got through that.
We believe in you, Keith.
All right. So Lucy Martin, auditor for Story County, helped me introduce Keith Morgan of Emergency Services, but also just, I guess, evidently a general good guy around town in Story City. And so Keith has come in today prepared to talk about planning for actor-shooter scenarios. Deep breath there. This planning is something you do whether or not there is an election day around the corner, whether or not there are white supremacist posters on campus and a white supremacist murdering policeman in Des Moines and Latina students being taunted with the chant, "Build the Wall." But all of these things are, in fact, happening this week, and I'm wondering whether those types of things are on your radar as an emergency services coordinator who deals not just with natural disasters, but also man-made disasters and eruptions of intense emotion or ideological fervor.
Well, active shooters or violent intruders, as the term is, has become to be known, has been an unfortunate event that has been occurring. And how law enforcement and the other first responders react to that has had to change because it was a bit of a new situation that we were dealing with. We learned a lot from the unfortunate aspects of Columbine and the Virginia Tech shooting. And the way the first responders had to react has had to become much more rapid and fluid to be able to adjust to the situation. And it is a different mindset for everybody that's involved, for the law enforcement that's responding, for our law, for our fire and our EMS. And that sparked us to start 2 years ago to get together to start to identify how we can be better at this and how to react quickly and develop what we call a standard operating guide that is on very general principles on integrating these different resources quickly and rapidly to be able to save as many lives as possible and to end the violence as quickly as we can.
So both of those sites that you mentioned are schools. I imagine that the schools have been involved in some of this planning in the standard operating guide.
We actually have kind of concentrated in the first responders on the development of the standard operating guide. It does dovetail quite well. You might remember that Sergeant Nick Lenny was here talking about the training they've been doing in the schools with what they call ALICE, which is DHS, Department of Homeland Security, calls it Run, Hide, Fight. It is one element of the overall reaction to it, and it's focused on trying to provide those that might be caught in these kinds of situations options to be able to counter what's going on and to make themselves a part of the solution as opposed to just sitting there and being a victim. It makes them into survivors, not victims, hopefully, right, as we go through this.
So you're working out a standard operating guide, procedures for all of the emergency personnel from different departments to work together to address a situation that might arise very rapidly. Communication, I'm sure, is a big part of how you're figuring out how you're going to communicate the emergency to each other.
And actually, a big part of that is being able to operate without communications as much as possible. We concentrated on working with the sheriff's office and are fire departments that don't normally work together with their law enforcement. Here in Ames, fire and law enforcement work together quite a bit. But the sheriff's office has got to go across approximately 10 different fire districts. So we brought them all in together. And speaking of the communications, what we want is the first 10 minutes, 15 minutes of one of these reactions to almost be able to operate without any communications whatsoever because the confusion and the amount of radio chatter that's going to be going on will make that difficult. So what we did is we sat down and we said, during the first initial reaction, what is the priorities of law enforcement? What is the priorities of the fire? What could be the priorities of the medical response folks? And how do these best interact so that we align the priorities so they were mutually supporting? So now law enforcement comes on in, and they already know how the fire is going to back them up and how medical is going to be prepared to start receiving those that may have already exited the facility and be prepared to work and go into the facility. A lot of it had to do with the management of the risk that is associated with these situations. And the link-up, one of the things that we practice in this recent workshop that we had is the link-up between law enforcement that's been inside of a building, very fluid, unable to really communicate much because they're very focused on a dangerous situation, how a link-up between them and the medical folks are going to work. So what we did is we had what we called a workshop. We put together a draft standard operating guide, and it began with Sergeant Nick Lenny again talking to our first responders and giving them some knowledge on what are some of the risks associated in being around one of these scenes and how to best protect themselves for the possibility of gunfire coming from inside the scene to the outside. Then we had the team that was doing a clearing operation inside do their operations, come out, and then link up with our medical folks to see how much information was going to be necessary to be transferred between the two of them so that they could feel comfortable to go into what is still an uncertain situation. And then the final step was to take these medical folks and fire folks and have them walk along with law enforcement that would actually be doing the operations inside the building. So now they have a perspective of what's going on inside the building as they would be on the outside of the building. We had over 75 different first responders, and what I think is so critical about that is these are volunteer first responders that took their evening to come on down and go through this training to help protect their communities, which is outstanding. Another great thing from it, it generated 11 different ways that we can improve our training, our standard operating guide, so that we can be better prepared for one of these situations.
Wow. So you're saying you actually went through a sort of a trial run of a mock situation. Where'd you do that?
We were down at the Justice Center that has a team that's already trained up on this sort of stuff. So we just dovetailed on top of their training. We just went ahead and matched up bringing in the fire and the EMS folks in on that night, and everybody learned something from the other folks that were there.
Yeah. I'm kind of curious about the fire. You know, they're first responders, obviously, when there's a fire. You're asking them to be first, or they're stepping up to be first responders in the case of gun violence. Is it mostly because of their proximity to, you know, because there's so many little fire departments distributed throughout?
Exactly. There's a very good chance that a local volunteer fire department may be the first on scene. And also, they can contribute by controlling the scene around there, which will be critical because parents may hear about it. In today's world of social media, we need to control the scene so that law enforcement has the best capability to know who's inside and give the opportunity for those that are inside to get outside, get to a safer environment. And that's one of the priorities that we established for the fire department, is to provide that perimeter around there. And also to start setting up a command and control system, because most of the law enforcement is going to be involved with reacting to what's going on inside. So they're going to start to establish that command and control that will grow as the scene, as they have more time on scene.
Well, that's just amazing to think that a volunteer force would be the first people there to arrive. But, you know, we live in a rural area. There's, you know, Story County, we have some towns here, but there's so much space in between. And like you said, just one sheriff's department for that whole area. And so it could well be a volunteer crew that shows up and deals with this, you know, in the first moments.
And the real value of this is so that they've had a chance to think through what the scene would be like before they did that. So there's always a bit of a shock that occurs if you run into something that you hadn't thought about ever before. Now they'll have had a chance to think about it, and they'll have, again, we established priorities. And if they just go back to these priorities, they'll be able to adapt it to whatever environment. We always talk about schools. But this kind of violence does occur inside of manufacturing facilities or any general meeting place.
Nightclubs and churches.
Yes.
In some cases. It's not something anybody really wants to think about, but I guess it's a good thing that you do.
And another aspect to this is I almost call it, if we can train to this most difficult level, should we have a smaller event that will require us to do many of these same kind of missions and taskings, such as a mass casualty incident, whether it be a tornado, whether it be active shooter, the more that we think about this, the more that we train on this, the better we'll be able to adapt to whatever kind of event occurs. Fire, establishing a good command and control system, is the same thing that they'll have to do if there's some sort of a disaster within a community.
Okay, we're talking about active shooter situations with Keith Morgan, our emergency services coordinator at Story County at the county level. I'm going to pitch just that question to you one more time. You're obviously working in one sense in terms of prevention, in terms of training, preparing. I'm curious whether when you see kind of an uptick of ideological kinds of disturbances around the county, such as we've had in the last week with posters, white supremacy posters on campus and attacks on Latinos, and then just one county away, a murder, double murder by an ideologically motivated person. Do you communicate with all the network that you have? Do those raise red flags that then, you know, kick in a certain kind of awareness to everybody, or is that maybe not as much your department?
We tend to look at it more as a civil unrest. The intelligence network that at a very generic level that we do have access to. Iowa is very restrictive on anything that deals with law enforcement intelligence, and that's fairly close hold. So we look at it more in the generic terms. And again, that allows us to not get too trapped in the details, but get people thinking about the general aspects.
The police, the Iowa state law is restrictive on police intelligence. You're saying that the police are not at liberty to share their info with more civilian type outfits.
Yes, there are restrictions on who can have some of this intelligence. They work well with us. It's just
there's kind of a barrier between you.
A bit of a barrier in between there. And my job is much more at the generic. It's as you might the terminology is operational, not the tactical level. If they say that something could come up that might generate a need for these kind of resources and these interactions, I'll take that and I'll work with them to try and prepare for it.
You take your cue from them.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Keith Morgan, for coming in, as you always do, once a month, to tell us about preparedness in its many dimensions here in Story County. We're going to reprise that lovely song by the New Seekers. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. We started out talking about the 10 judges up for retention on the ballot tomorrow with Guy Cook, a member of the Iowa State Bar Association and chair of its Fair and Impartial Courts Committee. We proceeded to talk to David Armiak, researcher at Center for Media and Democracy in Madison, Wisconsin, about Koch brother money in Iowa. There's a ton of it. Well, 30,000. We spoke with Auditor Lucy Martin and finally with Keith Morgan of Story County Emergency Services. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests along with relevant links to today's stories. And you can like us on Facebook and get updates on all of our show postings in your news feed. Local Talk was engineered by Evan Taylor. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was The New Seekers with their song I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878, or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.